Welcome to Industry Insights, the EFM podcast presented by the European Film Market of the Berlinale. My name is Elsa Kislasi, and I am Variety's international editor. This podcast series shines a light on highly topical, trend-setting industry issues. It's designed as a compass for the film year ahead, helping professionals navigate the fast-changing creative landscape. Industry Insights is a year-round podcast co-founded by Creative Europe Media. In today's episode, we share a fireside chat with David Kaplan. The conversation was recorded during this year's EFM. Let's start. Hello, everyone. Good afternoon and welcome to you, David. So it's a real pleasure to be here having this conversation with you, David Kaplan, New York-based, Brooklyn-based producer whose work over the last 15 years has shown us that it's possible to produce bold and original independent American films that break through commercially, but also at festivals. And you recently produced, actually, Josephine, which won two prizes at Sundance. And will be competing here at the Berlinale next week. And just found a U.S. distributor. So we'll talk about that slightly later. But I just also, during this conversation, talk about what you've done in the last 15 years. You've produced It Follows, you produced It Comes at Night, and you also recently produced, through your new company that you launched 3 years ago, The Brutalist. So that's a pretty big deal. Brady Corbett, and also Mona Fassbender's movie, The Testament of Anne Lee. So these are really successful independent movies. And I just look forward to exploring, first of all, how Josephine came about. Because from what I understand, it took you several years to make it happen. So starting with that.
Well, it's great to be here, and I apologize in advance for what I sound like. This is not normally my voice, but we will do the best we can. And to be fair, my partner, Andrew Morrison, produced The Brutalist and The Testament of Anne Lee. He's not here today, but he deserves the credit for that film, those films in particular, along with the filmmakers, of course. And truthfully, Josephine was 12 years in the making, and I can only claim to have been involved with the last three. I knew Beth for many years, and she and I had been developing a different project, a script that I had brought to her that she was intrigued by, and we developed it together. We were casting the film, and at a certain point along the way, through that process of developing the film and casting the film, she got to know Channing completely by chance. And so this project, which had been something that she had planned on perhaps making later in her life, because she had been trying and trying, but it was always very difficult, suddenly became perhaps slightly more possible because she had an actor, now two actors, because Gemma Chan had been involved for years at this point at Damien. And so when she suddenly had the parents for the film, she called me up and said, well, I know we're supposed to be making this other film, and I'm still very excited about that, but I now have two actors for this other script, and would you ever be interested in perhaps doing that first? To which I said, Gemma Chan, Channing Tatum, this beautiful script of yours that I read years ago that I know you've always wanted to make, the movie that you've always wanted to make, yeah, we should probably go do that. So that was October of 2023.
And was there a male actor who was already on board the project early on?
There were, as far, again, because I wasn't the producer, I actually don't know all of the male actors who were involved, but there were several, as far as I remember. The only one, and again, if I'm wrong, I hope I don't get a call about this being like, you're absolutely wrong, but I believe at one point in time, Matthias Schoenaerts, perhaps before the pandemic, was going to do this film. Again, Beth was trying to make this film for many years, also with many other great producers from America who, I joked to at least one of them, someday we have to have a dinner for all of the producers of Josephine, because collectively we all made this movie. It just took a very long time.
That's amazing. And so this project, why do you think that's why it took so long? Probably the financing, right?
Many reasons. I mean, it's I mean, we could have a whole conversation about that probably.
We're going to talk about that slightly later. We're starting to talk about the creative aspects. Then we're going to talk about the financing.
Yeah. And again, I was only involved from this last attempt to make the film. There were many before this. For the filmmakers in the room, I hope it's a reminder that if it doesn't happen the first time, the second time, or the 10th time, maybe the 11th time is the right one. Also, that if it doesn't happen, maybe it'll be the right one when it happens, and you'll end up with the version of the film that's meant to exist, if that's what this is. But financing is, of course, a challenge. I think also the subject matter.
Yeah, so talk about the subject matter. Yeah. It's an 18-year-old girl who witnesses sexual abuse, a sexual assault, and she has to testify in court, right? And it talks about her trauma a lot. So it is a very difficult topic. Did you feel some resistance when you pitched the project to people?
Resistance, concern, skepticism about the commerciality, worry about from parents about what this film is and worrying that it's too dark. And I think one of the things that's been most exciting and heartening about the experience of taking this film out into the world is the number of people I've spoken to since then who've said, it's obviously tough subject matter, but it's also hopeful. It's a conversation about parenting. It's a conversation about processing trauma. It's even at times even funny. There's a little bit of a levity in it. And of the people I've talked to who are assault survivors, I hope it's for everybody. Maybe it won't be the case, but the ones I've spoken to have said it wasn't triggering. And in fact, it was tough, but ultimately cathartic because of how the subject is handled. And of course, that's Beth. She deserves all the credit for that. But yeah, I think there was a lot of concern that who is this movie for? How is this movie going to be? Is it commercial? So, yeah.
And so from what I hear also, Channing and Gemma were extremely committed in the project, right? I think they're producers, right? Credited on the project.
They are both producers on the film, and for entirely worthy reasons. Gemma's involvement in this film dates back many years now. She stood by it when it was happening before and it fell apart, and she stood by it. And when it was time to make the movie, she made the time and was always so deeply committed to it and to the character that she played. Channing was a much later addition, but I heard stories from people who were involved in the film, people who weren't involved in the film, that he would see people who could finance the film and he would say, I'm trying to make this film Josephine and I believe in it so strongly and I hope you'll be a part of it. And so he was a part of the team raising the money and trying to make the movie. And you just don't see that very often. And so both of them, their commitment and their steadfastness, it's what you dream about in your actors. You dream they'll make the time. You dream they'll be down for the journey to make something as challenging as this. But to also have them be partners in the making itself is it's rare.
And so when you started working with Beth on the script, did you give her notes? Because I think you're a pretty creatively involved producer. What kind of, back and forth did you have with her?
This is where, honestly, I can take no credit. The script was written many years ago. The Sundance Lab, the project went through multiple versions of the Sundance Lab. She had other producers along the way who were, if I remember correctly, Kim Parker, Kyle Martin, John Baker. Josh Peters, who ended up being involved with this film as a producer, but also as a financier, who were involved in the development of the project. It's based on or inspired by true events.
Well, I didn't know it was based on true events.
It's inspired by.
Inspired.
It was extrapolated from something that Beth saw as a child. So I can really take no credit for the script. You know, we talked about the script, of course, in development of the production, but most of it was really about the practical realities of what we could raise in financing, what the movie would cost, what the priorities were, or seemed to be from a storytelling perspective. But in terms of sort of getting this beautiful story to the page and telling it in the best possible way, purely creatively, that's all Beth and her past collaborators.
So I don't know if I can talk too much about what we see in the movie, but there is the actual sexual assault scene that's pretty much at the beginning of the movie, and it's very, very graphic. I mean, I was really like, wow. And I wonder, like, did you feel at some point that you needed that scene, or could do you think that maybe that scene is the reason why the movie took so long to, you know, finance?
Honestly, I don't think even I understood until we were in pre-production exactly how we were going to go about handling that particular scene. We talked about it a little bit, but it's not until you're at the location, you're talking to the actors, you're talking to the DP, you're in pre-production, that you truly come to understand the totality of what it could look like and what it will be. I think we were always committed to showing something unflinching, and that's a choice. Obviously, we could have filmed that scene many different ways, but Beth wanted to do it in that particular way. I think we knew there was a risk, of course, in not shying away from the brutality of what happens. And I think we always were just hopeful that it was the right choice. There are obviously other films in cinematic history that have shown a brutal assault. This is doing it in its own way. There are other films, of course, great films that have chosen to be more reserved. And I think we were just hoping that in proportion to what the rest of the film was, that this would make sense. Have again been heartened that the general response has been, it was an okay choice, even as hard as it is to watch.
For sure, it's extremely emotional, and we just feel for this little girl. So the other thing that's really compelling in the movie is that this little girl, Mason, she's in nearly every frame of the movie, and it's such a harsh movie, harsh topic, very emotionally involving role. How did you find her, and how did you create a safe environment for her?
I'll just start by saying, for those of you who have not yet seen the film, and it has not played in Berlin yet in a public screening, so I imagine that's very few of you, if anyone, I cannot wait for you to see this girl. She's incredible. Not just because of her performance, because of her parents, and because of her family, and because of her approach to the work. It's her first film. She was not an actor before this. Beth, again, all credit to Beth, saw her in a crowd at a market 7 weeks before we started shooting.
How many girls did you see before?
We had local casting on. We wanted to find someone in San Francisco. We wanted to find someone who seemed like the right mix of Channing and Gemma. So we were looking for particular types of little girls. Some of them were professional actors. Some of them weren't. I think, I can't remember exactly. I think we maybe saw 90 in total. We had a few finalists, one of whom was a very established actor. Mason was only 7 at the time that we made this film. She turned 8. We had a little birthday party for her during the making of the film. She's actually younger than it was written on the page, but she seems so mature for her age. Just Beth immediately was like, she saw her at a farmer's market running around, and went up to her and said, "Where's your parent?" And she went up to her mom and said, "Would your daughter ever be interested in doing a film?" And again, in just like serendipity, her mom was immediately like, "Yeah, I think so." And also sort of alluded to the fact that maybe to some extent Mason always imagined that she'd be an actress. So it was just sort of serendipity. And immediately from the first time Beth started working with Mason in the casting process, she was like, "This is the girl. This is the choice." And honestly, again, to her credit, real skepticism on the part of the producers saying, "She's a little young. She's never acted before. She's a little young, not just in age, but also the implications of what it would have on our schedule. If we had cast a 9-year-old, we would have been able to work with that person more hours every day.
There is a difference between...
In America, there are labor laws, and so casting someone younger meant our schedule had to be longer, meant we had to spend more money on this film for days just to cast Mason. So it was, Beth had to make compromises creatively to cast this girl who had never acted before, who she met at a farmer's market 7 weeks ahead of time, and clearly it was the right choice. So I don't know, sometimes serendipity or just a brilliant director who knows what she wants.
For sure. So did you have her read the script or like?
Her parents read the script and knew, of course, what it was about. You know, Mason knew as much as felt appropriate, which was that it was a tough film. And of course, something bad happens in the beginning. She, of course, is in these scenes with Channing and Gemma, and the scenes are very intense. The film isn't just about getting over trauma. It's also about parenting. It's about how we talk to kids. It's about what we should tell our kids, how we don't necessarily know how to deal with those situations ourselves, how two parents maybe have different ideas about how to deal with a tough situation and how they talk to each other or can't talk to each other in those times. And so Mason has seen the film starting 20 minutes in. So she's seen most of the film. So she knows, of course, that, and of course has seen so much of her work in it. But it was always very intentional that we had to protect her from the hardest stuff. And her parents were, of course, on board, and creating a safe environment where that's possible was always as much a priority, of course, as making a good film.
So you talked about the working hours, and you also had a psychologist on set, or what did you have?
Yeah, not every day, because there's a dance scene in the movie. That's not a spoiler. You don't need a psychologist for a dance scene, unless it's a particular type. I'm not going to presume. I've seen Gaspar Noé's Climax. Maybe there was a psychologist there. But in this film, we had mental health professionals on the hard days, where it felt like not just for our actors, but of course also for our crew. Because I imagine, I don't know for sure, but I imagine a lot of the people who came to this film from top to bottom were here partially because of what the film was about, their connection to the story. And so making sure that we could do as well by them and their mental health was as important as, of course, our cast. And so we talked to mental health professionals before making the film. We had them on set. We had intimacy coordinators for all of the scenes with anything that was violent or just romantic, even, because there is also romance in the film. We had to. This is a film that required a lot of delicacy or care.
And so now talking more about the financing aspect. So how did you finance this movie ultimately?
Again, I think there's even versions of this film previously that were financed or close to financed, because Beth is not a total unknown, even though...
Yeah, she had made this movie Soft and Quiet before.
Which is incredible.
Incredible,
And she made it for almost no money. It came out a couple of years ago. It was a one-shot film, so very challenging sort of production. She made it in 4 days. She actually shot the film 4 times. From start to finish, just one take, and then stitch together the best take. So it's not really a one-er, it's a magic trick. But 4 days for production, it's crazy.
And it premiered at South by Southwest, right?
It premiered at South by Southwest. It sold for a lot more than it cost. So I think that was an important data point, maybe for investors, that this is a commercial filmmaker who could make a challenging film, again, about assault and about violence and about hate. And that movie was a very successful film financially, but also, I think, incredibly watchable. Gets nervous, uncomfortable laughs in a room. It's compelling. It's dramatic, but it's also thrilling. And so I think Beth had proven herself as a director since, you know, the last time she had tried to make this film. I think that's important. We obviously suddenly had our cast and Channing and Gemma together. I think people saw the possibility of that as a group of parents that could be exciting in a movie. And then also, I think it was very hard, of course. 99% of the people we went to and said, would you like to make this film, said absolutely not.
What was the one reason, you think? I mean, the topic, the...
I think there's two reasons. I think reason number one is perceived commerciality. A film like this isn't possibly commercial. Who wants to see something so dark? It's dark times. We need comedy. We need levity.
Romantic comedies.
We need romantic comedies. We need films with Jason Statham and Jerry Butler. We need lots of things. We don't need a film about assault. And I think there's also an inherent bias against films that are perhaps more geared towards women and assault survivors. And so I think there's a lack of belief in them as an audience and a lack of desire to try to find them as an audience.
Did you try to bring it to a streaming service?
I don't remember if we actually went to a streaming service during the financing process. Beth was always adamant about theatrical. And I'm pleased to say that both in the U.S. and abroad, I think we are going to be theatrical just about everywhere that theaters exist. And so that's a huge...
That's amazing.
It's a huge win for the movie. And I think the film plays really well in a theater as a collective experience. People gasp and laugh, maybe uncomfortably at times. And I think I've heard tears from hopefully a sigh of relief at some points. So I think it's great that it's theatrical. I don't think we went to streamers because I think we knew that it would just never happen. I don't even really, with few exceptions, we really didn't even talk to theatrical partners about this film before we made it, because I think, again, we're not idiots. We know that they would never say yes. We did talk to a couple, and their response more often than not was, that other script you have with Beth is really exciting. When that one's ready, we should talk about it. And we can't wait to see Josephine when it's done. Which is, by the way, a very common response. Most times when you're trying to get financing, the response is, we can't wait to see it. It's just not for us right now. And look, they're running businesses. You understand that. But no, we always knew that this had to be equity. We talked to a couple foreign sales companies before we started, one of which, WME International, Alex Walton, provided us with sales estimates, which said, if this movie is great, if it's as good as it needs to be. I think there's real value in the film. We were able to show those estimates to investors and say, look, it's only worth as much as the paper is printed on, but this very respectable man who's been doing this a very long time says, if the movie's good, maybe it's not a terrible investment. And I think that was meaningful. But ultimately, we knew it was going to have to be private investors. And so the film was ultimately financed by three equity companies, different sizes, came in at different points. But I can't say enough about all three of those partners and how grateful we are for them.
You can mention them.
Oh, yes. So the partners were Spark Features, run by Josh Peters and Rabina Ricciatiello out of Los Angeles. Spark is the patron saint of American independent cinema. They are responsible from everything from Dee Dee, which was at Sundance a couple of years ago, that Focus released, Max Walker Silverman's first feature and second feature. The most recent one was Rebuilding. This past year, they had three films at Sundance, ours and also Walter Thompson Hernandez's film and Ramsey's Ishak's film, both of which are still up for sale. Distributors plead by those movies. They finance small bits and pieces of equity. Usually they're not big financiers. They took a much bigger risk on this film, partially because they were the sole financier of Beth's first film. And so they had been successful investors in that film, but more critically loved and believed in Beth, and Beth loved them and wanted to work with them. And so they were our first investor. The second investor was a company called Kinematics, run by a filmmaker himself, a guy named Mark Rappaport, who is a director, a writer, and also a producer, who I actually met because of the previous film I was developing with Beth. And Mark's partners in the company is a guy named Manny Nunez, who once upon a time, a million years ago, ran CA Media Finance, so a very sophisticated finance guy who probably looked at the script and said, oh, I don't know, but believed enough in the project and in the team that he and Mark and their third partner, Jordan Rappaport, all said, we want to do this. And so before shooting the film, they were our two financiers. And in the making of the film, because we never had quite enough money, we had a third partner come in, a company called Yintai Entertainment, backed by a Chinese industrialist named Diana Chen.
Oh, yeah. What's the name of that company again?
It's called Yintai. Yintai had the film that was the biggest box office success in China, and they actually were involved in the American bringing it to America. So they've been involved in English language cinema now for a little bit. And Diana and her partners in this film were a producer named Brantley Gong and Christine Zhang, who's how I first met them. They came in during production, and again, we just could never have made the film without them.
How long before the shoot did you close the financing?
We closed the financing. Well, let's take the Yintai piece out, because let's just talk about the production budget. 6 days into principal photography.
That's insane.
We closed the bond 6 days in. The film was cash flowed, not knowing if it would fall apart even 2 days before we started production. If that had happened, I think we would have lost collectively about $3 million. Deals weren't closed. We closed the bond 6 days in. We closed actor deals a few days before. Now, to be fair, no one's fault. Things had to move quickly. We had a window. We had to go. This was the only way to make the film. And we had partners who were crazy enough to want to take that risk with us. And so again, this is a miracle. And we could have never done it without those three companies. Yeah. And we need so many more of them. And please, everyone in this room is a filmmaker, do not call them after this, because I'm sure they already get enough calls. But just know that they exist and other companies like this exist. And let this be a lesson to all of them that these companies are going to make good money on this film, and you can make a hard drama and it can be okay.
I mean, I don't know exactly about Germany, but I know that in Europe, there are so many countries where producers take way less risk because they can, you know, get a lot of subsidies, like a lot of soft money, etc., and pre-sales. But you guys decided not to take the project to the market, right? To have pre-sales, or did you try? And
yeah, I mean, we tried, but the market 100% said no. And I think the benefit of making films in America, there are so many disadvantages, we can talk about them. But the benefit is, ultimately, this is the risk that's required. It's understood. And we don't rely on subsidies. We don't rely on public funding. And so, if everybody in the world says no, it only takes one yes. And so you just have to believe there's somebody out there who wants to believe with you. And we found those partners. We, as a production company, took a ton of risk as well. So
that's
we had
what
to believe.
I hear. I hear you don't even have back end.
Well, no. I mean, everyone, no one has back end. I mean, none of the, no, there's, we didn't take a fee. No comment. But I think the more critical thing with this film is that we had to make this film for as little as humanly possible.
So what's the budget, by the way?
Well, it depends on whether you're a distributor or I'm talking to you honestly.
Yeah, honestly, it's just the two of us here.
Yeah, if you're a distributor, it was very expensive. And so as we are pre-selling the movie, or sorry, doing sales, and Goodfellas is our sales agent. If any of you are distributors, please call Vincent and Ava immediately after this. It was a very expensive film, and we won't take less than the most. No, we made the film. In America, there's a union contract called with IATSE called Tier 1. There's a maximum budget for Tier 1. We made it at the absolute top of that, because if we had jumped another tier, everything would have cost so much more. And it was the absolute most we could raise, and simultaneously the absolute least of what we could make the film for. So the film ended up costing around $6 million net, which is a healthy budget. It's a real budget. It allowed for everybody on the film to be paid more than a living wage, but it also allowed us to make the film in San Francisco, which is not the cheapest place to shoot a film.
It is expensive. Did you think of coming to Europe for the shoot?
Beth, and I'm so glad she did this, was always like, no, the movie has to be made in San Francisco, because I have the locations in my head. We have to shoot on the Golden Gate Bridge. We have to shoot in Golden Gate Park. The film, San Francisco, is not a major character in the film, but the texture of the city animates the movie. And I think it would be a different film without it. There are films, we have made films, The Brutalist and Ann Lee, both shot overseas. And there was a way to do those films as such, where we were able to, I hope the audience can tell us, give off the impression that the films were taking place in the places where we said they were. In this case, we could not fake San Francisco and didn't want to. And so, yeah, that made the movie more expensive. And therefore, we had to find partners who, again, thought, oh, you're making it in San Francisco? That's worth it. It's okay. It's where Hitchcock made films. Those worked. Yeah.
Definitely. And so the actors, because you have two well-known actors, were they were producing, so did they...
Like everybody else on the film, everybody sacrificed for this film in terms of how it was made, from Beth and her directing fee to the actors and their acting fees, no, non-precedential. On their next film, they should all be paid tens of millions of dollars. It's a no-quote deal. I have it in writing. And but you know, that's how you make a film with movie stars and a great director and great crew in an expensive city for that amount. It takes a village of people who believe.
Do you feel like because you didn't have a big studio on board early on, or like lots of commitment, did it give you more freedom, creative freedom?
Well, Beth had creative freedom, but you know, creative freedom, you can have final cut. In America, it's not a given, of course. You can have final cut, and it can still be a problem if you don't have the right partners. We finished production on this film in May of 2024. We premiered the film in January of 2026. For those of you who are good at math, that's a long time. It means we were in post for a long time, making sure that we did as right by the story as we could, being really patient, making sure that we were doing right by the color, the sound, the picture edit, doing a couple pickups with our actors when we thought, you know what, this could be just a little bit better, spending every dollar of contingency that we could to make sure that we did as well as we could by it. And at no point did any of our investors say, we've had our money in this movie for years, move faster. At no point did they say, you know, we like this, but can it be different? And not can it be different, it needs to be different. Otherwise, you need to move. You know, there was no pressure. And I think maybe if you're Paul Thomas Anderson making a movie with Warner Brothers, you get that kind of treatment. But I don't think all filmmakers working inside of a studio system necessarily get that privilege. And so making the film independently definitely gave us the flexibility to make Beth's movie her way.
And so now the U.S. deal is something that's super important, not just for commercial prospects, but also for award season prospects. Why did you choose this distributor who is really fairly unknown? Sumerian Pictures, I think.
Yeah.
I'm sure you were courted by other well-known distribution companies.
Yeah, we were lucky enough to get a few offers on the film from different companies. Although, interestingly, I don't think I'm saying anything too crazy. Interestingly, nothing worldwide, only deals for the U.S. or international, nothing crossed. So we found ourselves in an interesting situation where we were picking specifically between U.S. distributors, not world distributors. Again, I don't think we ever really envisioned this was necessarily a film made for streaming, nor did we. And again, I think we always dreamed of a great theatrical release. And we had a few offers, varying levels of financing, varying levels of theatrical commitment. Obviously, that plays some role in all of this. It was very important to Beth always that our investors made their money back if they could. They took tremendous risk. It's important to me as a producer in the same way. Why would anyone want to work with you again if you don't take care of them in that way, particularly in success? And so part of the calculus in what we decided was, of course, financial. But Sumerian, in addition to making a very meaningful financial offer, also offered a very meaningful screen commitment, a very meaningful P&A commitment. And so as a result, they were the company, and I want to say for the other companies that offered, we are so grateful for those offers. Not everybody offered on this film. Everybody told us they loved the movie. Everybody told us how great it is. Everybody told us whether it is or not, that's what they said. Don't know if you believe it, but it's okay. If they did, maybe they would have offered. Everyone told us they can't wait to see what Beth does next. I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that part's true. But only so many companies offered, and those that did, and we didn't go with them, we're forever grateful for their offers and their enthusiasm. But Sumerian showed the greatest amount by a decent margin.
I heard it's seven number.
Let's call it mid to high seven figures. So, you know, in this market, that's a huge financial commitment. That's a great outcome. And that's also not just a great outcome for the investors. That's a commitment that they are making to the film as a business that they need to now go and recoup, which means they have to push this film to make it work for them financially. They're running a business too. And so in thinking about why do you go with a distributor, you want whoever's going to be most invested. They told us this is going to be, you know, the flagship, you know, I don't want to say that they don't care about all the films on their slate. I'm sure they do. But this is a different type of movie for them. This is their first, this is an opportunity, you know, this is hopefully going to be something that is a film that they get to talk about for years to come. And so I think we just saw that in them, there was a partner who maybe had as much skin in the game as we did and could. And you want that.
And so right now you're really busy. So you're going to probably work with Beth on her next movie. And you're working with Bradley Corbett on his next project. Tell us about what's next for you, for your production company, Kaplan Morisset.
We were lucky enough to work with both Brady and Mona on their last films. Again, that's entirely my producing partners. Credit goes to him, and much more so to Brady and Mona, of course, and their other longtime collaborators. I feel a little bit sheepish talking about work that I'm only involved with because it lives under our roof.
Well, it's a small roof, so, I mean, you get some credit.
It is a small roof, so, and they're collaborators and friends and filmmakers we love and are lucky enough to keep working with. So yes, we can't really talk about Brady's next film other than to say there has been stuff reported in the press that perhaps there is a next film. Perhaps we, as a production company, will get to be involved with it. And perhaps it will shoot someday in the future between now and when we all die, which, you know, or not, because you never know. It could be 5 minutes from now. That's life.
But tell me something. Is it still possible to retain, filmmakers like that break through Oscars, etc.? Is it possible to retain them in the independent circuit, or do they get stolen by studios?
Well, I think stolen's a hard...
poached.
It's challenging, right? Because, we all have agency. So it's, you know, everybody gets to make the decision about what they want from their career. Also, everyone gets to make the decision about who they want as collaborators. I think the filmmakers who we're lucky enough to keep working with again and again, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to say I think we're going to get to keep working. You know, my partner Andrew worked with Mona on The World to Come, and then he worked with her on The Testament of Anne Lee. And so those are filmmakers we've been lucky enough to get to work with now for a few years. I think the filmmakers that we work with again and again, it's because it was a good collaboration, because we have trust, because we speak the same shared language, and we want to do it. I think if you aren't able to keep working with a filmmaker as a producer, ultimately that's on you. or the filmmaker. But I don't think that's, I would never blame the studios for that. I take personal responsibility if I don't get to keep working with someone. And that may be because I wasn't a good collaborator, or that may be because I don't want to work with them again. That's not, you know, that's the truth, right? And that's okay. And also that's no one's business but us.
But I also heard that Brady wants Final Cut. He wants to shoot in 65 millimeters. Like, it's very specific, right?
Well, I mean, again, I wouldn't read everything that's printed. Nobody from our side has ever said anything on the record about any of this.
Okay.
But what I will say is, in America, filmmakers are not given Final Cut. We as a company believe in filmmakers having creative freedom. And so we want to try and afford as much of that as possible in a system that does not believe in that. I think however Brady wants to make his next film, or any of the other filmmakers we're working with, it's important that films in this moment are an event and that they stand out in the market. And so large format filmmaking, shooting on film, projecting your films on 70 millimeter, as we have done on both The Brutalist and Ann Lee. And we've got great partners in Photochem and theatrical partners and exhibition partners who have allowed the films to be released in that way. I think as producers, we think it's really important. Budget does not dictate what is an event. What dictates it is concept, execution, and trying to think about how you distinguish yourself from everybody else. And so it doesn't take $100 million to shoot a film on Vista Vision. It just takes creativity, willingness, desire, and ultimately a filmmaker who has the vision to say, I have a film that I think will be better served made in this way. And so I think as a company, we want to do that. For myself, the next film that I will produce, I'd like to believe, is a sequel to a film I made many years ago called It Follows.
Of course, we all know that movie.
It's been many years in the making, this sequel. It will hopefully shoot in the months to come. We are actively in the casting process. We are in the script process, the budgeting process. We have partners in both U.S. and internationally to release the film. It is by no means guaranteed that it will happen. There are still things to be figured out, ultimately. But those things to be figured out are entirely in the control of the people trying to make the movie, as always.
Neon? Who's doing that?
Yes, Neon in the U.S. And then Neon did international sales on the film in 2022. So again, many years in the making. And actually, David Mitchell, the director, has even since then made another film with Warner Brothers. So this has been a long road, and I hope that that will be the film that we will make this summer. And then there are several other films that we hope to make in the next year to 18 months that have not yet been announced that probably shouldn't talk about quite yet. But I would say that, truthfully, I could not be any more excited about the one with the lowest budget than I am about the one with the biggest budget, or the one with the least experienced filmmaker to the one with the most notable one, because I think those films will all be special.
Beautiful.
And I'm in post-production on a film right now that we are hopefully going to picture lock very soon. That is a first feature. I don't know how many more first features we'll make. That might be the last one, just because I like having hair. I'd like to keep it.
You have a lot of hair.
Thank you.
But do you have a hairstylist?
I don't. I don't even brush it. This is just Jewish curls. Honestly, I have to watch the new cut maybe tonight. I think it's incredible. I don't want to overhype it, but I think it's incredible, not just because I think we've pulled off a small miracle in making this film that was so hard as any film I've ever made. I won't talk about the film in specifics other than to say that I think it is a film that speaks to what happened in the 1930s in Europe. It's what's happening in the world today. And it is trying to speak to all of those things in a way that asks questions and doesn't provide answers. And I think we're in a time where cinema and a lot of the work around what's happening rightly is trying to shine a light on what's happening.
The rise of fascism? Can you be more?
The rise of fascism, global conflicts, you know, war, ICE. There's many things that are happening in the world that are the brutality against the Jews in the 1930s, the conflict in the Middle East today. It's so complicated. The world that we live in is so complicated. And to make a film that hopefully comes at it with empathy and curiosity towards how do we think about this as a collective humanity and try and reckon with it all in a way that we ourselves are not saying how you should think about it, but just presents questions. I hope the film does justice by that ambition, and I have a sneaking suspicion it will. And once we premiere it, I'm sure it will be very hard to sell.
Well, for sure. Did you finance it?
The film is still only partially financed. If any of you are financiers, please come up to me afterwards, because we
absolutely... You pitched it really well.
Thank you.
But it sounds like a 10-hour movie.
It is 94 minutes plus credits. It's breezy. It's sexy. It's occasionally funny. It's quite dramatic. It's thrilling. But it's also about Schopenhauer and Leibniz, Leni Riefenstahl, America today, and America 100 years ago, and everything else. So it's a real meal. It's a first feature. It's a writer, director, producer, editor, who I don't just count as a collaborator. I call him a friend.
What's his name?
His name's Gabriel Nussbaum. Okay. And everyone will know his name in a few months. And yeah, the film has been financed with tiny checks, $50,000, $100,000 at a time. We still are missing about $1 million. The film is still financed on loans that I don't know how we're going to pay back. We are personally, as a company, are the lender. And so we can't pay our bills until we get that money out of the film. So anybody who's a financier, please come and save me afterwards. But also, if we don't get the loans out, God help me, it's going to be okay, because the movie's very good and it will find its way.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank
so
you.
Inspiring. You're so inspiring.
Thanks.
Okay, so off we go. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
A warm thank you to our wonderful speaker, David Kaplan, for sharing his insight on Josephine. And of course, thank you, dear listeners, for joining us and being part of this journey. And that's all for today's episode. This season of Industry Insights is produced in cooperation with Variety and co-funded by Creative Europe Media. Be sure to subscribe and help spread the word. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts and also on the European Film Market website at www.efm-berlinale.com. We look forward to welcoming you to future episodes of Industry Insights. Thank you for listening and goodbye.